Welcome to Breaking the Underdog Curse for Chiropractors. Hosted by Dr. Don McDonald, author of the best-selling book, The Underdog Curse. We give vitalistic chiropractors a chance to learn from the best around the world, discovering how they overcame their challenges and achieved success. In order for chiropractic to thrive, we must have thriving chiropractors.
It ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Now listen up. It's time to crush the curse.
Are you a people pleaser? I know I sure am. And when you mix that with being a chiropractor, it can create a lot of trauma. I know firsthand. It can wear away at your health, your relationships, and your practice. I term this the underdog curse, and I've spent the last 15 years coming up with a solution. My book, The Underdog Curse, was written to help others live a more authentic life. This is very challenging if you're externally influenced. When you take an externally influenced person and have them try to spread the message of chiropractic, it can be very challenging. If you'd like to get back to who you really are, regain your health, strengthen your relationships, and increase your worthiness, please visit Amazon.com and pick up your copy of The Underdog Curse today. Remember, if we take the time to nurture ourselves, we are much stronger at serving others. For chiropractic to thrive, we must have thriving chiropractors.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Breaking the Underdog Curse. This is Dr. Don McDonald, your host, and today I'm going back down to New Zealand. I've gone there a few times in the last few episodes, but we have a lot of friends and a lot of people who are doing some amazing stuff in New Zealand, and I want to make sure we get that message out to the whole world. So my guest today, his name is Dr. Kelly Holt, and I've met him before at the New Zealand College of Chiropractic Lyceum. And then I got to meet him really good at Fiji on Fire, because at Fiji on Fire, we spend less time in the seminar room and more time at the pool with beer. So that's the time when you get to meet everybody. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kelly.
Good to be on board with you today, Don.
That's awesome. So for those people out there that don't know Dr. Kelly Holt, did you graduate in 1999 from New Zealand?
Yeah. I was in the first class at New Zealand College.
The first class, right?
Yeah, so that was quite a journey.
Yeah.
First class in a program, there was, you talk about moving goalposts. We had no idea where the goalposts were most of the time. But, it was a cool thing to be a part of, though, in that inaugural class. One of the cool things was seeing that, the college was set up by such dedicated people who just wanted the profession to flourish. And they were putting their heart and soul into it and their money for us, so we could graduate and give back. And you could really feel that.
Yeah.
Because these days, you go to a college, you go to university, and you kind of feel entitled. Here's my money, give me my education.
Right.
For us, it was, the people like Phil McMaster, who's the president there now, putting their absolute heart and soul into it. And we wanted to give back to them because of everything they put into it. So, it was cool being part of that first class. And also incredibly frustrating at times as well.
Oh, I can imagine. I'll get into that a little bit later because I heard some stories about it. But how did you, because for those people that don't know, now Dr. Kelly's in full-time research. And not just any research, because a lot of times, especially in Canada, the buzzword for research is evidence-based for low back pain and having protocols for low back pain and neck pain. And for us vitalistic chiropractors, that's kind of like sticking a knife in our eye. Like we don't really, that's not really super inspiring for us. So for those that don't know, Dr. Kelly Holt's working his butt off creating research that more vitalistic chiropractors can kind of use. And he does that full time now. But I wanted to first get to know Dr. Kelly, the person, a little bit more. So how did you even start to think you wanted to be a chiropractor in the first place?
Well, I've been going to see a chiropractor for a long time. So I think my mum took me along when I was about 10. I was getting headaches. What do you do for headaches? You just take drugs every day, which didn't really make sense. So my mum took me along to see a chiropractor, Lionel Blackburn, who was a bit of a legend from days gone by, the Commission of Inquiry in New Zealand, that sort of thing. And helped me a lot with my headaches, and we would just go regularly. And then his son Doug took over the practice. I was finishing up high school, didn't really know what I wanted to be doing, so took a gap year And during that time, I went in to see Doug, and he said, you know, what are you going to do? He said, I don't know, haven't really worked it out yet. He said, why don't you become a chiropractor? There's a college opening here in New Zealand next year. And so it was really him planting the seed. And I thought, well, you know, I come in here, you are having a heap of fun. He's bouncing off the walls. And, you know, it was like, well, that's really helped me. So why not look into it? So I went home. And back in those days, no internet, I was looking it up in the encyclopedias. So what is this?
No internet, baby.
Yeah. And, you know, got more and more into it and then put in an application for the New Zealand College.
I was curious, what did it say in the encyclopedia that chiropractic was? I don't think I ever looked at the encyclopedia.
I can't remember now. It was so long ago, but yeah, I can't remember what sort of definition it had.
Yeah. That would have been interesting. Point. That's funny. So you decided to go, and was that kind of a little bit scary? Like just to be in an inaugural class in a brand new school, it must kind of feel kind of weird.
It's, was a little bit scary. I remember turning up to one of the first lectures with Phil McMaster, and he said, you know, you guys are amazing that you're coming along to, you know, be a part of this program where we don't even have any accreditation, and you know, you don't even really know if you're going to graduate, something like that. Really? But you know, it was a really interesting journey. We were pretty tight knit. You know, a small class, I think there was about 19 of us, and you know, very close, and some of those friendships from that class, you know, my best friend Simon was in that class. It's like family, you know, we were like family. It was so close and awesome to be a part of.
Yeah. And it's funny because I was interviewing Nick Laurie, and he said that he used in the second class, and there was like no stress for him because he said, if you guys didn't all pass, like the school wasn't going to survive anymore, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. When we came to graduate, you know, you couldn't get accreditation until the program had been run through. So the first class had come through. And so we finished up with our, you know, final year at college, and we didn't have any accreditation, but we were going through that process, which doesn't happen overnight. And a deal was done with the chiropractic board where we had to sit an external exam, which was put on by, I think it was by RMIT, which is a college from Australia. We more or less had to sit their exit exam. And I think it was something like 70% of us had to pass at 70%, and if we did that collectively, we'd then be eligible to sit in New Zealand board exams. And the education we got was very different to the education at RMIT.
Yeah.
So we had to have a crash course in how to pass an exit exam from a college which was over here.
Yeah.
You know, very diagnostic type of college, whereas we're much more vitalistic with our training. And you know, we all came together and really did work our butts off over the course of probably 2 or 3 months, and then did this exam, which, you know, I still break out in a sweat thinking about this exam. And I remember driving into the last exam I had and just yelling in my car. It's like, you know, I was getting so frustrated that we'd gone through this whole thing, and these people were there judging me, and we could get to the end of this and not be able to practice.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, because if we 70% of us didn't pass, the college probably would have fallen over. They would have had no accreditation. So there was a little bit of weight on our shoulders. And
well, that's like 4 years. Like you do 4 years, and then at the end it could have been like, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think 71% of us passed.
Wow, so it was close.
So it was close. But made it through. Then we had to sit New Zealand board exams, which were a piece of cake compared to what we'd just been through.
Yeah.
Remember my son was 2 weeks old when I was sitting the New Zealand board exams. So
oh, man.
We were going in with no sleep, but we got there in the end.
I've interviewed so many people who've had kids while they're going through all these crazy stuff, and I thought I could barely survive. I was just looking after myself, let alone looking after a little human and trying to do all that at the same time. So that's pretty amazing.
Mm, yeah, it was certainly interesting trying to study for those board exams with living in a tiny little house with this young baby who was crying all the time, and we had people coming with us. And I remember being up in the only place I could escape to was like the kitchen in the middle of the night with, you know, the baby in my arms, and I'm trying to read something or other for this exam. Fun time.
Oh, jeepers. Okay. So cool. So you get out, you pass your exams and you're free to practice. Did you start off in practice or when did you kind of start to be interested in research?
Yeah, I started off full-time in practice, and probably after only about a year or so, maybe even less, I wanted to give back to the college. So I started helping out as a, what we now call mentors. So supervisor in the intern training clinic. And that was just like 3 hours a week or 6 hours a week or something. And pretty much every year I'd get dragged in a little bit more. So, how about you teach this one class? How about you do this? How about you do that? And probably 4 years into it, maybe, Randy Beck, who was a lecturer there at the time, dragged me into a research project. He said, why don't we do this? We've got all of these x-rays. Let's look at what sort of anomalies are on these x-rays. So, we were doing this in our spare time, and I really enjoyed it. Got a bit of a buzz for it. And then just, the ball was rolling and kept on going with it. We did little projects here and there. It was basically a spare time, really. Didn't get any time release or anything for it, and it just grew from there. And then I think in 2006 Heidi Horvick came on board at the college, and that's when things really started to happen. We set up the research department, and we actually got paid to do some research, which was quite a novel idea. In the weekend, sitting at my computer mucking around on spreadsheets or whatever, thinking, why aren't I out playing golf or fishing? What am I doing here doing research for fun? So that was quite cool to be actually given some money to do some research. Right. And then I went on and did my PhD at Auckland University. And I think 2009, I started doing it full time.
Cool. So ever since, from 2009 on, that's all you do is full-time research?
Yeah. So last 9 years, full-time research.
That's amazing. And it's our type of research. That's so cool. And was that a point that you guys were really trying to do, is try to keep it more on the vitalistic aspect of research rather than the pain-based stuff?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we figured you've got plenty of people out there doing back pain research. We really want to understand more about these subluxation things and how they influence human performance. Mm. So, from day one, that was our goal. It's, we're teaching our students about subluxations. We get so much criticism about them. No one really knows what they are. So we want to know more. We want to know how they impact the nervous system, how they impact human performance, and how chiropractic care really works. So that's what interested us from the beginning. And, we wanted to do research that was that flavor, because most of the research that was happening out there in the big wide world that related to chiropractic just didn't really spin our cranks.
Yeah, that's cool. And so how many research projects have you been involved in, like kind of over the whole gamut of your career so far? Approximately, I don't know if you know.
I don't know. Probably had 30 or 35 publications so far. We're actively doing something like 42 projects at the moment.
Wow.
So quite a lot, spanning all sorts of topic areas. And we've got this whiteboard at the college, and we use this wonderful system of tracking where these projects are, which is post-it notes, and it's either in the design phase or data collection or the write-up. And we have these going through that through our whiteboard, and we've got a whole heap at the moment that have moved into the publication phase. So there's really quite a lot coming out over the next year or so.
That's awesome. So for maybe the chiropractors that are not so familiar with the vitalistic research, which they should totally be, can you give maybe some examples of some cool research projects that you've done and what you've kind of discovered from those?
Well, one of the biggest ones I was involved with was in my PhD, and that really stemmed from could chiropractors help older people in preventing falls? So I started looking at balance. You know, falls are a major problem. About a third of older people have a fall each year.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people, they die from them. There's massive rehab costs, hospital costs, and you know, big impact on society. And it made sense to me, if we adjust someone and improve their nervous system function, then that could have an impact on their balance and their abilities to stay upright. So the main trial that I did in my PhD, I looked at 60 older people, divided them into two groups of 30, and one group received 12 weeks of chiropractic care, and the other group just carried on doing their usual day-to-day stuff. And we looked at things like joint position sense error in the ankle. So, you know, your brain and ankle communicating with each other. Do you know where your ankle is in space? Because logically that would be a good thing for preventing falls. We looked at something called choice stepping reaction time, which is how quick can you take a step to stop yourself from falling. So we'd have this platform and there were lights on it, so panels that would light up, and you'd have to put your foot on this panel, the idea being that's similar to reacting to a trip or a slip. And we wanted to see how quickly people could do that and whether that time decreased when we'd adjusted them. Another thing that we did in my PhD, this was a bit of a left field thing, was we looked at something called the sound-induced flash illusion, which is basically looking at the way you put together auditory and visual information and combine it, so multi-sensory integration.
Yeah.
What we know with older people is those people who aren't so good at combining all of these different types of sensory information, they're more at risk of falling. So, you know, this was kind of left field. What's that got to do with the spine? You know, the way we combine vision and sound. But I thought that would be an interesting thing to look at, because that would go, it was right up the alley of the model of subluxation that we're looking at, the neuroplasticity model. So we looked at that, you know, a few other things. We looked at quality of life as well, because, you know, we talk a lot about quality of life, but we don't have an awful lot of research that shows that chiropractors help people with the quality of life, because we just haven't done the studies. And the cool thing was, you know, I was getting to the end of this PhD, which took me, I can't remember, maybe 8 years. So from the bringing up the very first concepts of it, starting some of the research and then progressing right through it, I think it was about 8 years in the making. And I was getting right to the end and I had no idea what I was going to find. I thought, you know, I thought we could have a negative study. We didn't look at any of the results until right at the end. I thought I could have just spent the last 8 years doing this and we don't have any positive results. I don't know what we're going to get.
Oh.
And I was bracing myself for it. And then the cool thing happened was I started getting letters from these older people in the study. You know, no one writes letters anymore. And these letters were turning up. And it was people thanking me for inviting them into the study, because they got 12 weeks of free chiropractic care. And they were telling me what a massive difference it made to their lives.
Wow.
You know, there's one guy in particular who, he was 89. And when I first met him, he was really sprightly. He was a really cool guy. And he started telling me his story. And it started out with back in World War II, we were in an artillery barrage in a foxhole. And my best friend died in my arms because of a shell that, you know, landed close to us. I got shrapnel in my shoulder. And I've had pain in my shoulder ever since. And then in 1950, I rolled my car and smashed up my arm and I started getting headaches. And in 1960, I rolled my car again. I don't think he's a very good driver. And for 50 years, he'd had 10 out of 10 headaches, migraines, headaches every single day, and incredible neck pain, shoulder pain, and arm pain. And he said, you know, I've just learned to live with it. I'm happy. I'm healthy. It's like, wow, 10 out of 10 pain and you're happy. But anyway, he got under care and over the course of the 12 weeks that he was under care, all of that stuff went away. Headaches went away, migraines, arm pain, neck pain, everything. And, you know, the chiropractor was doing nothing to his arm, nothing to his shoulder, just checking and adjusting him like we usually would. And he said to me, "You've given me my life back by being in this study at 89.
Wow. And that's so awesome.
Getting those stories, I thought, even if we don't get the results with the stats, it'll still be worthwhile. But as it turned out, when we adjusted people over the course of 12 weeks, we improved the way their brain and body communicated. We improved their ankle joint position sense. This choice, step, and reaction time, that got a lot quicker. One of the cool things with that choice, step, and reaction time is we measured them at baseline and after 4 weeks and 12 weeks.
Yeah.
After 4 weeks, there was no change at all.
Wow.
But after 12 weeks, a massive change, really big change. And that's always something that stands out to me is, you know, in practice, we're used to the miracles and we want to see things happening straight away. And when they don't, it's, oh, maybe it's not working.
Right.
Maybe we'll give them time though. You know, so this didn't change after 4 weeks, but between 4 and 12 weeks, we saw a big change in the way they functioned and their ability to take this compensatory step and control their body. So that was really cool.
That's awesome. And
one of the other cool things was that sound-induced flash illusion that I was talking about, the way that we combine the auditory and visual information and multi-sensory integration, that improved in these older people who are under care. And the cool thing with that is no one else had shown that they'd been able to change the sound-induced flash illusion, but the thing that did make an impact with it was chiropractic care. So, you know, the way that we perceive, process, and integrate and respond to our environment changed when we adjusted them. And it had, you know, what's that got to do with the spine? Nothing. Yet it changed the way the brain was functioning, which is really cool.
But we now know, so the spine's so connected to the brain, right? So that's so awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And their quality of life improved as well. So, you know, that's probably the biggest study I've been involved with, and we had some really awesome results there. And we've done lots of others since. We've done quite a lot of work looking at strength. So changes in strength, people getting stronger after we adjust them. And we've got a few studies that we've published and a few in the pipeline looking at that in athletes and stroke patients and also normal healthy people.
Mm-hmm. And if someone was to add, like, kind of they wanted to get a copy of the research that you've done, or especially for that PhD, where could they find that if they wanted those analyticals out there?
Well, they've all been published in peer-reviewed journals, and some of them aren't open access. Like my PhD study was in JMPT, so that's a little bit more tricky to get the full text, but all the abstracts are available online. Most people are only interested in the abstracts anyway.
Yeah.
If they do want to know more about the research that we're doing, they can always contact me. But a lot of the studies we do these days, we publish them in open access journals because we just want to get them out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of the studies we do, we publish them outside of the chiropractic journals as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, more of the mainstream, a lot of what we do is neurophysiology. So we go to the neurophysiology journals. They're ranked higher than the chiropractic ones as well.
Yeah.
And we get less prejudice with from the reviewers, because, you know, sometimes we have a hell of a job trying to publish in a chiropractic journal because we use awful words like subluxation and adjustment. And the argument is, well, no one will understand what you're talking about. We need to use scientific words like spinal manipulation or joint dysfunction. And so, but we're chiropractors. Can't we use our own words? And often the answer is no.
Really? And so when you go outside of chiropractic, they're more accepting of our language than inside chiropractic?
They tend to be more accepting, yeah. So it's kind of ironic, but we get hassled less if we're talking about subluxations and adjustments in neurophysiology journals than we do in chiropractic journals.
Wow, that's interesting.
We cop quite a lot of criticism from our own people at times for not using our chiropractic language.
Yeah.
And often it's because we just can't.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So along the way of research, I know in Fiji, when we're on Fiji and Fire, you talked a little bit of a story about it was in Afghanistan that you had to travel to?
Pakistan.
Oh, Pakistan. Tell the listeners a little bit about that story and the study that you're doing. Because that was pretty cool, because you also collaborated with some people over there that didn't know anything about chiropractic too.
Yeah. So one of the researchers on our team, Imran Khan Niazi, he's a biomedical engineer. He was originally from Pakistan, then did his master's in Germany and did his PhD in Denmark. But he still had links to the university that he did his undergrad work in Pakistan. And we wanted to do a study looking at strength in stroke patients. Now, we'd already done a study which looked at healthy people. We adjusted them and they got stronger. And then logically it's, well, what difference does that make to them? Probably nothing. But what if we adjusted someone who'd had a stroke who's got weakness? What if they get stronger? That could really have a big impact on their daily life. So we wanted to do a study in stroke patients, and in New Zealand, trying to get your hands on stroke patients is really difficult. Mm-hmm. Other researchers get to them first. There's kind of like a gatekeeper who says, okay, you can have this stroke patient, you can have that one. And in Pakistan, they have lots of people who've had strokes, and they don't get much in the way of care, and there's no one doing much in the way of research with them. So we had this opportunity to go to Pakistan, work with the university over there, and just have the steady stream of stroke patients come in that we could check and adjust and see what happened. So it took quite a while to put this all together, but we built this relationship with these researchers in a university in Islamabad, and we teed it up so we could go and visit for a couple of months. And we actually did quite a few studies while we were over there. But the key one was with these stroke patients, which is actually in the publication process now. But before going, I didn't know what to expect when I got there, because I think I just watched Homeland season 4, which was based in Islamabad. And
yeah, no.
Blown
bring,
up.
And bring your bulletproof vest.
Yeah. And I remember having dinner the night before I went, thinking, geez, is this the Last Supper, you know? Why am I going to Pakistan? And actually, on the way over there, I sat next to a New Zealand SAS soldier who had been in Afghanistan, and he was telling me all of these stories about car bombs and stuff like that. So I was even more worried by the time I got there. But we landed in the airport in Islamabad. And I think a lot of the people on the plane, it might have been their first or second journey on a plane, because as soon as the plane hit the runway, everyone just jumps up and heads towards the door. You know, as the reverse thrusters are on, we're still screaming down the runway, and everyone's walking around the stewardesses and sit down. No one's paying any attention. But that was the first interesting thing, was, oh, this is weird. Then when I went through the airport, got through customs, walk out the front door, and the guy in front of me got hit by a car. So he's walking across the pedestrian crossing. A car hits him, bounced off the bonnet, lands on the road, stands up, dusts himself off, waves to the guy, and keeps going on his way. It's like, whoa, that's weird. And then after that car had gone by, this forklift drove past with a car on it. So he had parked the car somewhere by the airport, got out, walked away. So they just go and pick them up and dump them somewhere else in the airport just in case they're going to blow up.
Oh,
interesting. And then I managed to find Imran, who's there a couple of days before me. And we had a car waiting for us. And looking around, this is weird. There's people walking around with machine guns and what have you. And we get to our car, and the driver is having a heated argument with a soldier who's pointing the machine gun at him. And the soldier didn't look very happy at all. I thought, oh my God, we're going to get shot before we've even left the airport. Yeah. And as it turned out, Imran had phoned him to say that we're going to be there shortly. the soldier was telling him, you need to move your car. And the driver had held up one finger saying, 1 minute. And the soldier thought that he'd given him the finger. And so had brought him out of the car and wasn't overly happy with him. And they were having this argument. More soldiers arrived, more machine guns. Then Imran tapped one of them on the shoulder and said, you're embarrassing us in front of the foreigner. And they looked over and saw me and decided that everything was okay. And we got on our way and ended up back at the university where we were staying, which was an army university. So checkpoints, looking for bombs as you go in. You know, it was snipers on the roof, that sort of thing.
Oh, really?
It was... but we got used to it really quickly. So after a day or two, I was probably more worried about getting killed on the road because of the crazy driving and traffic than I was of being shot or blown up.
So you weren't like a secret agent running from building to building and doing a dive and roll on the ground as you're like...
No, not too much. No. Certainly an interesting experience in the name of research.
Well, on behalf of chiropractic, thank you for risking your life for research to show that when you get adjusted, even if you've had a stroke, you get stronger. What was your results? What did you find with that study?
It was quite incredible, actually. We had, I think it was about a 64% increase in strength in these weak leg muscles when we adjusted them.
Wow.
Which really blew us away. We've done a lot of these strength studies, and usually we'll see about an 8, 10, 15% increase in strength when you're adjusting them. And in these stroke patients, it was 64, 65% increase in strength straight after an adjustment.
Wow. That's cool. Did you guys have any hypotheses of why there's such a huge difference like between the regular people and people with strokes?
Well, it's probably just because they've got the weakness, so there's more room to improve.
Right.
We had no idea what to expect, but those results really did blow us away that, such a big increase in strength.
That's cool. So what kind of, you said you had a few research studies that are going to be coming out the publication right away. That was one of them, right? What are some of the other ones that might be coming out that people can keep their eye open for?
One of the other ones, one of them that just came out is a reliability study. We've been doing a bit of work looking at reliability of finding subluxations because, we've got some of our wonderful researchers who say subluxations don't exist. And one of the reasons that we say they don't exist is we can't reliably find them. And, in practice, you're not just making it up, you're finding something there.
Yeah.
So we decided to do some studies looking at the reliability of finding subluxations. And believe it or not, you can actually have two chiropractors who can find the same subluxation. So that was published recently. I think it was between about 63 to 80% of the time that agree on the level of the subluxation in different regions of the spine, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
The stroke study that should be coming out soon. We've got another strength study looking at arm strength. And often when we do these studies, we don't just look at strength. We also look at what's causing that change in strength. And it's coming from the brain. So, originally we thought maybe it's stuff happening in the spinal cord, spinal column. But the changes in strength that we see when we adjust someone, they tend to be brain-based. Another one that will be coming out shortly, Alice Cade, who's one of our graduates and lecturers at the college. She's just done her master's degree looking at kids with ADHD and reading and motor control in the eyes. And in her study, there was improved reading time, so decreased reading time in kids with ADHD after they're adjusted. What else do we have on the go? Those are the key things off the top of my head at the moment. I could look through the list of the other 40 studies that we're doing.
That's good. Now, just kind of for just the chiropractors out there. So you're in research, you've seen a lot of this. You got some chiropractors out there that just graduated and they might be feeling a little bit shaky with their certainty. And what kind of words can you give them that you have found indefinitely that like, true to the bone, now that you've been doing this research to help them with their certainty?
Well, when I graduated, you know, we were confident that chiropractic helped people and that adjusting people improved the nervous system function. We didn't know why. We'd been told it. It seemed obvious when we were checking people in the chiro center, the health center. But there was always a little bit of a nag in the back of my mind of, well, we don't really know how this works. And through the research that we've been doing for, close to 15 years now, study after study just gives me more and more and more confidence that we're onto it. You know, this chiropractic thing, it's all about the way your brain and body communicates. Mm-hmm. This idea of subluxations affecting your nervous system function, all of these studies are adding up. We've got this model of subluxation, neuroplasticity model, and study after study is supporting it. Supporting the idea that when you adjust someone, it improves the way your brain and body communicates, improves the way that you perceive, process, integrate, and respond to your environment, and that's got to be a good thing. And I just have 100% confidence now that we're onto it with this model. And, the model, we don't know everything. It changes with the results that we get, but I'm just filled with confidence that this subluxation thing, it's real, does exist, and it affects the way your nervous system functions. When we adjust people, it improves human performance, the way your brain functions.
Right. And so for some of those, the researchers out there that say subluxation does not exist, have you had a conversation with anyone like that before, or a debate, or what would you say to those people?
Yeah, I think, I do talk to them and try and find out where they're coming from. I think when they say that subluxations don't exist, for a lot of them, it's that they have this idea that we're still living in the past and it's this monocausal subluxation thing that causes all disease. And, you have a subluxation that causes autism.
Right.
You have a subluxation. That's not what we're saying happens. Mm-hmm. But to them, I think it's, you think a subluxation is this nasty thing that causes all disease, and that doesn't exist. So when they say the subluxations don't exist, I think it's because they think that we're saying a subluxation is something that we're not saying it is, living in the past.
Great.
So often that's where we get to when we're having these conversations. But for some of them, it's, well, you can't reliably find them, so they just can't be there. So we're just going to manipulate the sore bits in the back. And so, well, maybe we're just not good enough at the study that we're doing.
And right.
That's why we're doing these reliability studies and trying to up our game there to show that we can reliably find these things.
That's cool. And when does that reliability study come out?
One of them was just published a couple of months ago, Chiropractic Journal of Australia. So that's open access. People can find that online. Just Google Chiropractic Journal of Australia and it will come up.
Cool.
Their most recent edition, I think.
That's awesome. Now, in your estimation, what needs to be done in the future? So coming up as far as research goes, what needs to happen in order for us to move the needle more towards supporting vitalistic chiropractic?
A lot of the studies that we do are basic science studies. It's all about understanding the mechanisms of action associated with adjusting people. I think to really have a big impact in the big wide world, we need to do more clinical trials. They are hard to do well and outrageously expensive, but we just need to do it. Mm-hmm. With a basic science study, it might cost, say, $80,000 to do a basic science study. You might be looking at $1 million, $2 million to do a clinical trial well. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of effort, but I think that's what we need to do. That's what really interests me. But to do that, we need the money and we need researchers. So, there's not a lot of us, not many of us, from our side of the profession doing research, and we can be stretched pretty thin. So, right. To produce a good researcher, you're talking 15 years now. It's a long apprenticeship. And we've been pretty slow getting the ball rolling there. You know, we've got some really amazing people coming through doing PhDs now and master's degrees working with us. But for quite a while, you know, it's been a small number of us doing research that's of our flavor, and we've been stretched thin and haven't necessarily had the resources to do as many studies as we want and the big studies like the clinical trials.
Right. What if you have, say there's chiropractors out there that are like really interested in doing research. Maybe they're in practice or they're just graduating and they're interested in doing our type of research. And the tough part is like, even in Canada, a lot of the research chairs are at universities and it's kind of like they're in physiotherapy departments and they're just doing back pain studies. So what kind of advice could you give them to move forward into research or give them some steps forward into research in the vitalistic mindset?
If chiropractors are interested in doing some research, the obvious place to start is writing up a case study. So yeah. you can write up a case study without going through the whole ethics approval process, which can be quite daunting if you're not familiar with it. And the case study, you know, you're reporting on things that happen in your practice, and we see some amazing things in our practices, and we need to. Look, research is built on observation, so we need to know what happens in practice to be able to design the bigger studies or to be able to justify doing those studies.
Right.
So if we have enough case studies saying, when we adjusted this person, this weird thing happened, they felt better, they improved with their quality of life, their performance, we can then use that to justify doing more studies, more clinical studies. So if you're interested in getting involved in research, that's a great place to start because anyone can do it. Anyone can write a case study. And you know, for a lot of people, you'll probably get to the end of that. You've written a case study and decide that's not for me. Others might decide I kind of enjoyed this. I'm going to go down a more formal track and do some postgraduate education. So that would be the place to start, I'd suggest.
Mm-hmm. And so if someone went down and got their PhD to become a researcher, how does it work? Do you have to be affiliated with a school or do you have to be affiliated with a group? Because like I said, I know here they go with the university, but then that kind of controls what they're researching.
Yeah, that's a bit of a challenge depending on where you are. We've got some really cool collaborations going with our local universities, and universities love postgraduate students because that's where they get their money from. The government likes paying universities to graduate people with a PhD. So where it works really well for our group is we will help our students do their PhD through a local university, often collecting data in our labs. We'll be co-supervisors. So their main supervisor might be always at the local university. But we know some really awesome people who are open to our guys doing chiropractic research. Mm-hmm. Now this is even physiotherapists. We work with the physios at one of the universities. They give us a bit of stick from time to time, but it's all in good humor. we can do, you know, chiropractic research with them. Some other places around the world, you'd be a little bit more limited because often you've just got to work in with a research program in a university. If they're not doing chiropractic research, then you don't always have that freedom to, you know, design your own project. It all depends on the university though.
Right. Cool. And so I know because, Brandy, she's a board member of the Australia Spinal Research Foundation, and we've always been a big supporter of that because, and you guys have used funds from the spinal research, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in our early days, we couldn't have done it without them.
Yeah.
Our labs really did get set up by funds from ASRF. They support a lot of our early projects, and yeah, without them, I don't know if we could have done what we did. They've been awesome over the years.
And so for a lot of people, we've been a big supporter, and Brandy's like really championed them as well. And so we'll put that in the show notes for the Australia Spinal Research Foundation. Because if we can get everybody, I always say if we have a hub that's creating funding for Vitalistic Research, we don't need to reproduce all the expensive stuff. Like, we can just all funnel it there, because the nice thing about chiropractic research is that we're not big enough, so we can share it to the whole world. So even though the research is done in New Zealand, we can still use it in Canada, or you can still use it in the United States or the UK. So, you know, if people want to get involved, make sure you get donating and giving back to research, especially our type of research. So I want to thank you for being on the podcast. What I like to do is, you always give the last couple minutes for the floor for our podcast guests, just to give any words of inspiration to the chiropractors out there. Like, some are frustrated, some are stagnant, some just want to be a little bit inspired. What kind of words of wisdom would you like to share with our guests?
I suppose the key message is, we know from the research that we're doing that when we check and adjust someone, it improves the way they function, improves their nervous system function, the way they perform, improves the way that they interact with their environment. It improves their life. Keep on doing it. Get out there, adjust as many people as possible, because, you know, you do make a massive difference to them. The research is supporting that. I'm more and more convinced of it every day. So have faith in what you're doing. Know that you are having an impact on these people and improving their nervous system function. Adjust more people.
That's awesome. And everybody, just imagine that, 15 years of research, and every single study that he's doing, he's just getting more and more certain about chiropractic, because it just keeps growing and growing, the evidence. Please, if you don't donate to the Australia Spine Research Foundation, please go on there. I think it's like $30 or $40 a month, just the basic level membership, just to start donating. If you have any friends that have like $2 million, just contact Kelly Holt, and we can just quickly do this, do the proper research, right? If you just had $2 million, that would be pretty good.
Yeah, that would be really quite awesome. Yeah, I'd appreciate it. Anyone that wants to give us $2 million, we'll welcome it with open arms.
Okay, so that'll be our thing. Is, if anybody listening to this podcast knows someone who'd like to donate $2 million, that'll help with the cause lots. And then we can just get right to the good stuff. So,
absolutely.
So thank you so much for joining me all the way back, all the way down from New Zealand.
It's been fun, Don. Always good to catch up.
Yeah, and we'll hopefully see you again sometime soon, somewhere around the world, because we always kind of end up meeting up. We won't be at Fiji on Fire this year, but I'm sure we'll catch up somewhere. And for all those listeners out there, you know, we talked all about research today, because that's the one thing that everyone says we don't have is research. And yes, we do. We just need more of it. So get out there, be confident, see more people, donate to chiropractic research so that we can get more vitalistic research in the books, and don't forget to crush the curse.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you receive value from this episode, please take some time to rate and review us on iTunes or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. If you know a fellow chiropractor that could benefit from this message, please share it with them. Because it's my goal to provide you with great content, please contact me if you have any questions at drdonmcdonald.com or find me on Facebook. I look forward to hearing from you. So until next time, Dr. Don out.